Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, keeping it cozy this Christmas season.
And what scientists have learned from a decades-long oil leak on the USS Arizona.
But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
Donald Trump was nearly assassinated. He should know. And he called out political violent rhetoric and said it should stop. And he didn't even make it to Thanksgiving before he's calling for us to be hanged.
The state is facing a challenging budget, but so are many, many Arizonans. I hear over and over again, things are unaffordable, and this is making it easier on them. And I think we owe it to them to deliver that.
Litigation is not off the table, but we are really pushing him hard to make reforms that would prevent that misspending of taxpayer dollars.
She knows perfectly well there is no misuse of funds in the ESA program by the Department of Education, and that the Department of Education has implemented many processes to avoid misuse of funds.
This isn't just a legal issue. This is lawfare by candidates and by parties who don't want the 35% of the people who are independents to be able to participate.
And joining me to talk about the latest in the saga between Mark Kelly, President Trump, and Defense Secretary Hegseth, whether Arizona SNAP recipients could lose their benefits again and more, are Christina Corrieri with Consilium Consulting. Christina, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mark.
And Gene Woodbury with Creosote Partners. Gene, good morning to you.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So, Gene, let me start with you on what we've been seeing with Mark Kelly. Certainly, after the video that he and others participated in telling members of the military that they do not have to and, in fact, should not follow illegal orders, he's not been quiet about, you know, what folks have been saying about him or why he thinks that he was in the right to make this video. I'm curious what you make of his strategy over the last couple of weeks in terms of really being out there talking about this.
You know, this is the most I've loved Mark Kelly since he's been elected. What I've wanted from Democrats since Trump was reelected is to pick fights like this and not back down and to say, if you get told to do something wrong or if you get told to do something illegal, you don't actually have to do it. And then once you make that stand, you stick to it and you say, whatever you say about me, I'm going to take that and I'm going to keep moving forward.
Is there something about this particular fight you think that makes it a good one for Kelly? Because he's certainly gotten criticism and the others in the video for, you know, for not pointing out, you know, have there been illegal orders? Or if there have been, what are they? You know, some on the right are saying, you know, look, they're just trying to stir the pot here.
Well, it's a good point to make. It's a good point to just say, here's a very simple fact that you as a member of the military have this duty to not carry out illegal orders. Now what we're exploring is the illegality of orders that we have seen recently, especially with these boat strikes. But the point of the video is not to determine that. That's got to be determined in a more structured setting. The point of the video is just to say you need to be evaluating this in the field when you're faced with an illegal order.
Christine, I'm curious what you make of this. Like, is this a good fight for Kelly to be picking?
Well, I think it depends on what your goal is. If his goal is to raise his profile nationally, then yeah, it's good for him. If his goal is to have members of the military constantly questioning every single order, I don't know that that's good for the country. So he made a statement that is factually accurate, that members of the military have a duty to not follow clearly illegal orders. But by doing it as a video with six elected Democrats, it becomes inherently political. And it has the suggestion in there that there are perhaps many orders that have been issued that are illegal, rather than having that debate where it should be. If it was truly a nonpartisan reminder about what the military code is, you would be doing that video with retired members of the military, not with politicians. Hmm.
How much do you think this has raised his profile nationally? I mean, obviously, he was on the short list for vice president with Kamala Harris last year. He's, you know, as many people point out, a former astronaut. He's raised a ton of money. Has this really raised his profile, do you think?
Oh, I absolutely think so. You cannot turn on any 24-hour news station and not see coverage of what's going on. And that's just going to continue as Trump strikes out at him and he strikes back.
Gene, obviously not getting into the motivation of anybody or, you know, looking at the policy that he was talking about, but from a purely political level, does this help Kelly if he, say, wants to run for president in 3 years?
I think Mark Kelly could have won in this election. So what we're looking at here is, can he demonstrate continued leadership?
And how do you think that he would use this episode to try to do that?
I don't think that this is an instrumental action to get more political leverage. I mean, to the extent that everything is political, sure. But fundamentally, this is his background. This is his expertise and his career. And he's saying that as a principled leader, all of these other people that are his colleagues have a similar duty to act on their principles.
Hmm. Yeah, go ahead, Christina.
You know, I think there are Republicans who are asking legitimate questions about some of the current orders as it relates to the drug boats in the Caribbean, but they're doing it in a fundamentally different way. Rand Paul, for instance, is out there raising questions about this action without congressional approval. But they're not going out pretending it's nonpartisan. I think that video of the 6 Democratic members, they were pretending it was nonpartisan when it was inherently partisan.
Inherently partisan because they were all
because
of the same party?
They were all elected Democrats. You have put 6 politicians in a video, right? If you wanted it to be nonpartisan, use non-political figures.
Christina, let me stick with you and ask about a lawsuit that was filed this week by the Citizens Clean Elections Commission against Adrian Fontes, basically saying that the Secretary of State should not have allowed what the party that used to be known as the No Labels Party to become the Arizona Independent Party, essentially saying it's confusing to voters, especially those who choose not to be a member of the party, who are often referred to as independents. And what do you make of this?
It's absolutely going to be confusing to a large majority of Arizonans, because when we use the word independent, people use that colloquially, right? They don't belong to the Republican Party or Democratic Party. I'm independent, right? Well, in Arizona previously, if you were independent, what you actually were party not declared.
Doesn't really roll off the tongue.
Doesn't roll off the tongue. People who are steeped in politics like us and probably most of the listeners understand that that's what P&D is. That's not necessarily what most of the people who register as that understand. So we have the second highest number of registrations in Arizona are P&D. It's 1.5 million people. If even 10% of the people register as the Arizona Independent Party thinking that's what it means, they are going to lose a significant number of constitutional rights that we hold dear. The first being they're not going to be able to vote in the primary election unless the Independent Party runs a primary.
And they can't vote for the Democrat or the Republican.
They can't vote for the Democrat or Republican. Right now, as a person who is a party not declared myself, I have the option to select a Republican ballot or a Democrat ballot. I'm used to being able to do that. If I registered as an Arizona Independent Party, I would no longer have the ability to request that. I also couldn't sign a nominating petition for somebody running as a Republican or Democrat for the legislature or any other office in Arizona. And I think people are not going to understand that, and they may understand that too late. If you're not registered 30 days in advance of an election, you are not going to be able to vote in that election.
Gene, do you buy into the argument that this might be confusing or would be confusing to party non-designated voters?
I think this is a terrible idea. I think that you're going to end up with people being registered with a party they didn't know existed. We have a system now that works for the people we would call independents, people who register without a party. And that system is clearly popular because more people register that way than register as Democrats. And close to the number of people who register as Republicans, this is a system that works. If you want to change it, there's ranked choice voting. Maybe that helps those voters. But what we've seen with Paul Johnson, who's behind this new idea, is that everything he does, he says, is in the service of people who aren't part of the two major parties. But this is going to silence the voices of, you know, independent voters. And what he did with Prop 140, which was a sort of jungle primary top two pseudo-ranked choice system, that was also going to bury the voices of independent voters. We need to stick with what we have or think about something that can actually help people.
Is it worthwhile to have, regardless of what it's called, because I guess the legal question is, could the Secretary of State have stopped the name change? And I'm not a lawyer. I don't know. This will be litigated in court and, you know, this will be for the courts to decide. But I guess, is there, Gene, in theory, a place for people who, like an organizing place, maybe call it a party, maybe call it something else. But for people who do not want to be members of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, like, is there a place for something like an independent party, if not called that, and maybe if not in the form that current organizers are putting it in?
Well, I think what we've seen, unfortunately or not, is that it hasn't worked out. The Green Party doesn't fulfill that. The Libertarian Party doesn't fulfill that. The No Labels Party, which is now the Arizona Independent Party, also didn't fulfill that. So that isn't working in our current structure. Maybe there's a room for it. Like, maybe that's a good idea, but it's not going to work with the structure we have now.
I would say there's always opportunities for a third party. We have them in the Libertarian Party and the Green Party. They have remained small, but historically you've had third party candidates that their ideas then get absorbed by one of the two major parties. The problem is not that there is an additional party on there. The problem is the name and the intent to even if it's not the intent to deceive, it will in practice deceive some number of people. Also, I think the law specifically allows the Secretary of State to recognize a new party. I don't believe there's actually a mechanism to allow the renaming of an existing party, and that's what that lawsuit is about.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the courts say. All right, we'll take a quick break. Christina Corrieri, Gene Woodbury. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guests this week are Gene Woodbury of Creosote Partners and Christina Corrieri with Consilium Consulting. Gene, let me ask you about what's going on between the state and the federal government. We saw, of course, during the government shutdown that ended not that long ago, that SNAP benefits, the food assistance benefits, were lost for a lot of folks. And there's a lot of consternation about that. Well, now we're hearing from the USDA that those benefits in states like Arizona could be rolled back again if the state does not turn over information to the federal government, which says it's trying to root out, you know, waste, fraud and abuse is the phrase that they're using. Governor Hobbs has so far said that she's not going to turn that information over, and it doesn't seem as though that's going to change. So how do you see this playing out?
I'm really proud of Governor Hobbs here for refusing to comply with something that really seems like it's designed to prey on hungry families who might have mixed immigration statuses. You know, it's perfectly legal, regardless of your immigration status, to apply for SNAP benefits on behalf of your citizen children, for example. That's something that would be missed in a mass reporting of data. So this is one of the better things I've seen from Hobbs in terms of pushing back on the Trump administration, especially now that in a very short amount of time, we've seen SNAP funds leveraged in this way.
Is it a tough thing for her to do, and maybe a tough thing to continue? I don't justify is maybe not the right word, but to explain doing if and when Arizonans lose their benefits because the state has not turned that information over.
Well, this is something we saw with the shutdown negotiations. We got to this point after the longest shutdown in history where this was clearly the issue. Will you back down or will you keep up the fight given that SNAP funds are being used as leverage? And the mistake was that they backed down. And so in the end, it just looked like a lot of Sturm und Drang for nothing, right? And what Hobbs needs to do here is learn from that and stay true on the path of protecting Arizonans.
Christine, I'm curious what you make of this. You served in the Ducey administration, and I don't think this particular issue came up at that point, but he obviously served while President Trump was in his first term. Do you think this is the right move for the governor to withhold the information at the risk of losing this federal money?
You know, the people I feel sorry for are the 850,000 people in Arizona who are on SNAP. Over 300,000 of them are kids. Many of the rest are disabled individuals. They are elderly individuals. And they're going to have to go through a lot of uncertainty. I think that Governor Hobbs has picked a dangerous path that is going to put all of them in jeopardy to potentially protect a few. that may not be here legally. It is true what Jean said, that citizen children of undocumented immigrants have a right to be on SNAP if they meet the other eligibility criteria. But what wasn't pointed out is before the passage of H.R. 1, there were certain classes of undocumented immigrants that were also eligible for SNAP. So, for instance, individuals who were paroled into the country, as we saw happen by the tens and hundreds of thousands under Joe Biden's presidency. Also, individuals who may have had a deportation order, but that deportation order was withheld. So in H.R. 1, they made significant changes to who is eligible, making it only individuals who are legally present in the United States that have had that green card for a certain period of time. States were given 120 days to comply with those new requirements. So the Department of Ag does have a legitimate interest in ensuring that states are complying and rooting out what now would be fraud, waste, and abuse because of those changes in eligibility.
Is that is the USDA the best organization to do that as opposed to the state? Because the state, my understanding is the state already tries to make sure that people who aren't eligible or shouldn't be getting these benefits or any benefits aren't getting them.
Correct. The state has the obligation to do that. But understand that historically and currently, the feds pay 100% of benefits. So if the state gets it wrong, the state isn't risking anything. The one who's ultimately paying is, well, the taxpayer, but also through the federal government. And so they have an interest in making sure that the states are doing it correctly.
Jean, obviously, again, taking the human perspective out of this, obviously people and food and their food security, from a purely political perspective, Christina mentioned this is kind of a risky strategy for the governor. She's obviously on the ballot in 2026. Could this be an issue that helps or hurts her in her reelection campaign, do you think?
Well, like Christina said, there's many people in Arizona who depend on these benefits. And I think that those people are alienated when they hear terms like fraud, waste, and abuse. I don't think that they think that feeding their children is fraud. I don't think that feeding their children is waste. I don't think that feeding their children is abuse. And so when Governor Hobbs stands up and says, I'm on your side, that's a message that they're going to resonate with.
So two other candidates who are on the ballot in 2026, Attorney General Chris Mays, Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn. They're in a little bit of a tiff this week over ESAs. Chris Mays says that litigation is on the table over the Education Department's policy of letting ESA school voucher purchases under $2,000 go through and then auditing them later and trying to claw back the money if there's a problem. Christina, this has been such a big issue, and in the school superintendent's race will continue to be a huge issue in the primary and going forward. What do you make of this back and forth?
You know, this is inherently political. The ESA issue has been for a long time. I think that Superintendent Horn was able to snap back and say that they have referred multiple cases over to the AG for prosecution, including, I think, one case where somebody spent 40-something thousand dollars on crystals and that the attorney general has declined to prosecute them. Look, it's complicated. It's a new program. There are going to be learning curves. They have to figure out how to get these funds, you know, out in a reasonable amount of time, but with those checks. And he's put some risk-based software in. I think this is a popular program. It's a growing program. I believe there's about 100,000 kids in the program right now. With a program that grows so fast, it also needs administrative resources to be able to do that. And ultimately, I think the legislature should appropriate more funding to the department to get those tools that they need.
So, Jean, obviously, Democrats, Governor Hobbs on down, have been trying to she tried to just undo the universal ESA program. Republicans in the legislature said no way. They didn't say it quite that nicely, but they said no way. The Democrats tried to put some reasonable guardrails on the program, presumably to make sure that money that went out was going out for the right purpose. Republicans in the legislature have pretty consistently said, much what Christina said, this is a popular program. We're not looking to make any changes to it. So I guess the legal question comes down to how – and again, I'm not a lawyer, but is it okay that the money goes out and is only looked into after? But politically, this seems like it's, again, going to continue to be a huge issue up until and maybe beyond November of next year.
Well, I think Attorney General Mays is right that this is probably not a legal way to disburse funds as, you know, a state agency. and that needs to be explored. I think that the interesting question for me is the political position that puts Tom Horn in. He is now facing on his right, which is not something I thought existed, a primary challenger backed by Turning Point,
Kimberly Yee, state treasurer,
Kimberly Yee, saying, you know, Tom Horn, you've gone too far. You've put too many guardrails on the ESA program. I'm going to primary you. And then, of course, on the left, he's being challenged by a Democrat with the party line of this is a system that's just fundamentally not working. So Tom Horn is in this position of having to figure out, how do I administer this program correctly and legally without just imploding politically?
Which seems like a really interesting, very quickly, Christine, a really interesting place for someone like Tom Horn to be.
It is. But I also want to add, there's nothing unusual about auditing funds on the back end in certain programs. There are grants that both the federal government and the state government do to nonprofits or other groups where the money is sent out. And on the back end, when they send their reporting, it's audited and money is clawed back if it's inappropriately spent. And nobody disagrees with that. I don't think that what the department is doing for those lower dollar purchases is really any different than that. Everybody wants to go after actual fraud. It should be found and it should be prosecuted, but they also have to find a system that works.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Christina Corrieri, Gene Woodbury, thanks you both for coming. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why scientists are still studying the USS Arizona nearly 85 years after its sinking.
But first, Mark, I think it's fair to say that it's officially the holiday season.
Indeed. We actually yesterday just had a segment on the show about why the Valley is so obsessed with Christmas lights. So yeah, I'd say we're pretty much there.
So the question is, what kind of Christmas season will it be? The show's favorite digital culture expert, Amanda Kerberg, has some thoughts.
This season is really about staying in, having a really cozy time with friends and family, doing crafts. It's not about that kind of really like excessive consumption or going out, partying, big concerts that we've seen in recent years. This is sort of getting back to basics.
So, Sam, it sounds like maybe a cozy Christmas on tap?
It would seem so. As Amanda told our co-host, Lauren Gilger, that's the vibe.
Think like candlelight. Think, you know, soft music, homemade food, maybe sitting around doing some coloring or, you know, doing a little crafty Christmas ornament kind of thing. Like I was just talking with some friends the other day about TikTok videos of people making garlands out of like velvet ribbons and paper. And so it's like that
lovely
vibe.
Yeah.
It's like, let's have a deep conversation. Let's do some crafts. let's maybe bring out the ornaments from, you know, our parents' attic. Like that's yeah. It's like, it's kind of nostalgia. It's plaids. It's Little Women. It's Ralph Lauren. It's very like classic. Yeah.
Yeah. I love all of those buzzwords you just hit on. This is my vibe. Okay. Can we, Amanda, pull off a cozy hygge holiday season here in the desert when it's not that cold?
I do love the idea of a hot hygge because, yeah, because the whole idea of hygge, right, that we get from Danish culture is the idea that this is what's going to get us through this season when we cannot go outside. So it's like, okay, it's basically the treat yourself season. It's the let's look at the terrifying cold weather through the window and let's have some sweet treats and some candles and snuggle under blankets. Now, that's different for us, right? Because in winter, it's beautiful outside.
It's when we actually want to go outside.
Yeah, yeah. So you know what? I say pivot a little, bring in some LED candles. You don't need to add the heat. Or maybe like just punch that AC down a little bit and then you can put on a cardigan inside. I mean, I honestly do hygge anytime I go to the movies. It's freezing there. So
true.
So yeah, honestly, there are so many different ways to incorporate the feeling of hygge, even if you can actually go outside.
Mm-hmm.
I say even just, you know, open the sliding door, bring in the beautiful outside weather, but also take time to sit down with friends, ask each other maybe deeper questions than you would on an average day, play some cards, like do that. It's a very analog kind of thing, mm-hmm. right? It's getting off the screens, putting the phones to the side and really connecting with people.
Yeah, that sounds great.
What's leading to this kind of vibe you're seeing in culture right now? Like, you know, these are tough times, right?
Yes. Yes. There's a lot of economic uncertainty. So when we see like earthy tones and these kinds of classic Christmas of like greens and browns and maroons, like these things we associate with nature, that kind of color scheme and cozy feeling tends to go with that economic uncertainty. So like people are being super frugal this holiday season. How do we cut back on our spending? Mm-hmm. How do we find ways to really enjoy this holiday without maybe as many presents under the tree? How do we create new decorations or, again, bring in the old ones in a way that still feels like a really, really beautiful celebration, but isn't like, okay, oh, we're doing pink Christmas this year. Let me go buy every single new pink thing I need to.
I mean, so there's a lot of like social stress I feel like people are under. But when you're talking about something like an analog holiday that feels cozy and sort of non-digital, that maybe is an antidote to some of that stress, right? Are we hiding from it a little bit?
I think so. Even though we can go outside, it's a sort of like metaphorical, let's get inside, let's get real cozy and not think about the political, social, economic stress that is kind of pervading our lives right now.
Yeah. And there feels like no escape from. Maybe this is our escape from it.
Yes. Yes. In a time of extreme information overload. Yes. I think sitting down to play some cards with a little LED candlelight is a perfect idea.
That sounds great. What are we watching this cozy holiday season?
Oh, that's, you know what I'm really anticipating is the new Knives Out movie is coming out. Yeah.
Not a holiday film, but I get the vibe.
I know. Yeah. See, to me, solving a murder is always a holiday tradition. But yeah, so we're going to get our new Benoit Blanc look from actor Daniel Craig, who honestly, you know what? Great inspiration for how you decorate your holiday table. he's very like Ralph Lauren, like
classic.
Classic three pieces tweeds. You know, it's a good look. Other than that, gosh, it's hard to pick specific things because they're so much.
Where do you stand on like the traditional Christmas movies? Do you watch them every year?
Oh, you know, I'm a Muppet Christmas Carol purist.
So good.
Yes. And so I have to watch that for sure every year. If I don't get my cheeses for us Mises, it is not Christmas.
Marley and Marley.
Yes.
Okay, so this is an interesting take I think you have on this, and it's totally happening, this cozy kind of cutting back, frugal feeling holiday season. But the other big trend that seems to be happening in pop culture right now, at least among like the celebrity, the upper echelon that we're seeing on TV, right, is like this 1980s-esque excess, like very conspicuous consumption. Like the very wealthy are doing very well right now. And we're watching that play out in real time in like celebrity gossip. Jeff Bezos' massive wedding. We've got the Trump ballroom being built at the White House. I mean, how do these two things coalesce? Is this like the cozy Christmas reaction to that excess?
I think that's one way to look at it. Yeah. I mean, definitely throughout history, we see that dichotomy a lot, right? That sometimes when a lot of us are kind of struggling and cutting corners and pinching pennies, I mean, you know, shout out to the penny, we loved you. there is kind of an excess on the other side of the spectrum too. And I think there is a way to see it as a little bit of a reaction to that of just, oh, that might look a little gross to me. And maybe I'm kind of, you know, hate watching is such a big thing now in the way that we consume both media and culture. So I think there is an element of kind of hate watching that level of extreme like billionaire consumption and pulling away from it and saying, well, no, that's not really what I want to embody this holiday season.
Or can.
Absolutely. I mean, look at just the reaction to was it Bill Ackman's pickup line that's going viral now where he said, may I meet you, is his recommendation. Like there's just a – we are kind of bonding by looking at the billionaires and going, nope, not me.
No, but not me. Okay, so lastly then, Amanda, tell us, you know, what are you looking forward to most this holiday season? What's the moment you can't wait for?
Oh, my gosh, that's such a good question. I think there's something about the way that the world stands still for a moment, even if it's just that sort of magical, you know, week that we all consider the central moment between Christmas and New Year's when it seems like everything is quieter.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of quiet moment is so hard to find these days. And, you know, we're all trying to find these little chances to kind of disconnect and reconnect. And there is something that feels like almost like a liminal space.
I love
it's
that.
It's just, it's quiet and you can, maybe you're smelling a Christmas tree or maybe you've got candles or whatever is happening. You just have a moment that feels like it's just yours and, yeah. and time isn't even moving around you. And maybe you don't even need to know what's going on that day.
Yeah. Yeah. What a lovely thought to end on, all right? That is Amanda Kerberg, a PhD student at Arizona State University's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communications and the show's resident digital pop culture expert. Amanda, thanks as always. Happy holidays.
Thank you so much. Happy holidays to you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Sunday is Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day, marking nearly 85 years since the USS Arizona was sunk on a day that President Franklin D. Roosevelt said would live in infamy. And as it turns out, the ship has been leaking oil since that time. New research details those small leaks and what scientists have been able to learn from them. Chris Reddy is a scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution on Cape Cod. He joins me to talk more about the work he's been doing at the site of the USS Arizona. And Chris, is it surprising that this number of years after it was sunk that the ship is still leaking oil?
Yeah, I mean, so the USS Arizona was sunk on December 7th, 1941 by the Japanese when they attacked Pearl Harbor. And 1,177 souls were lost. And from all accounts, oil has been leaking from that ship since then, and now it's part of a memorial. Best estimates are about a gallon a day, 2 gallons a day, but there was 1.6 million gallons on the ship. It got filled up, unfortunately, the day before the attack, so it had a full load. And best estimates are that there's probably about 600,000 gallons still on the ship.
Wow. And how does that oil now compare to the makeup that it had in 1941?
Oh, yeah. That's why I go to work every day. So thanks for asking that, Mark. Yeah, because, you know, I'm always curious about how nature responds to uninvited guests. Because, you know, oil is, you know, that oil in that tank, you know, nature is trying to figure out how to way to push back on it or if it's even getting released. And so, you know, we don't know what that oil looked like on December 7th, but we have a pretty good idea. And I would say that surprisingly, the oil has not changed that much in 80 years. Some microbes have eaten a little of it, but I can tell you I've worked on other oil spills where we have seen more degradation in 6 weeks than the 80 years that we see at the Arizona.
Wow. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's about packaging, which is that all that oil in the Arizona is still pretty tight in the tanks. And it's not very well aerated. So there's not, you know, think about a fish tank where you have to bubble in oxygen. Mm-hmm. That helps keep the ecosystem going. There's not a lot of oxygen there. The water is not always getting refreshed. You think about it, that oil is stored really deep in the bowels and it's leaking out a little, but it's not a great place for the microbes to want to eat. And so the end result is they have a relatively fresh oil 80 years later.
It sounds like it's almost more pure than what it would have been maybe had there been a bigger leak or had there been a bigger hole in the ship or something.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. This is an unusual occurrence. You know, there's 5,000 World War II shipwrecks. And, you know, the key thing is, and they all have some fraction of oil on it. And it's not an if, but a when. All these oil starts to release. Some are already, you know, the Arizona is only 1 gallon a day. And it is of no concern in the big picture. I wouldn't think about trying to remove that oil. It's a national shrine. I think it has the shrine and the significance of that supersedes this relatively small volume of oil. But what it does do is it does give us a snapshot on what oil looks like after 80 years, at least in one location. And it's surprising. It's surprising how a well-packaged, a well-built ship like the USS Arizona has not corroded enough so that you have much attack on this oil in these tanks.
So does that tell you then that shipbuilders of today should be looking at the Arizona to try to determine how to build their ships in the hopefully unlikely event that they sink or and otherwise like are in a position where their oil might leak?
You know, I'm not a metallurgist or a marine architecture person, but I do think we want to celebrate that the corrosion resilience of the Arizona is certainly good news. But the value of the USS Arizona is that it is a living laboratory that allows us to understand what happens to oil in 80 years later. There are 5,000 other wrecks strewn in the Atlantic and Pacific, and we are constantly trying to assess the threat of oil that releases from them. But for the most part, we haven't analyzed oil from those wrecks. It's hard to get at. And so we're trying to plan for a problem, but we don't have all the data in hand. And that's where the Arizona comes in place, because we at least have, we know where the oil came from, we know when it was sunk, we know where it's been. And so at least gives us a little bit of a toehold into what we might be expecting in the future.
So do you anticipate then that what you learn from the USS Arizona will be most helpful in dealing with other shipwrecks from many decades ago, as opposed to oil spills maybe more recently?
Absolutely. I can tell you right now that the value that we have gotten from studying the USS Arizona is paving the way for having a better understanding of oil that's releasing at iron, what they call iron bottom sounds, which is from about 60 Japanese and 40 or 50 American ships are sunk as part of the Battle of Guadalcanal. And so we're using that information to help understand ongoing leaks that are happening from Japanese or American ships there.
Is there any reason to believe that the conditions on the Arizona will change, either the condition of the oil or the amount at which, the rate at which it's spilling out?
Well, you know, that's an active project. You know, the National Park Service, oversees the USS Arizona Memorial and a larger part of a memorial at Pearl Harbor. And they are actively studying the corrosion there. You know, it's hard to predict the moving forward. I tend to think that a lot of the oil is below the mud line, which is it's buried below. And that's kind of good news, because when you get deep into mud, there's not much oxygen. And so there isn't any rust going on. And so I'm pretty hopeful, based on the data we have in hand, that, you know, it's pretty secure for the time being. To the point where I would say that there's no plans that should need to be done in the near future to try to think about removing the oil.
Interesting. And I would imagine if you had to do that, that would be quite a sensitive project, given the nature of the Arizona, and as you say, the memorial that it includes.
Yeah, this is such a non-trivial, you know, the USS Arizona is such a critical component of our national history that we have to move. I will say, though, that when I first started working on the site with the National Park Service, United States Coast Guard, one of the first things I had asked was, is this okay? You know, I've been on the Arizona collecting samples, and you know, it's incredibly moving. One day I was the only person on the memorial. The dock that they used to deliver 2 million visitors a year was broken. And so I was able to access it by kind of an emergency chute type ladder. And it is an incredibly moving. It's probably one of the high points of my career. But I've asked multiple times, and the Park Service has spoken to, when they started working on the corrosion in earnest in the 80s and 90s, they spoke to the survivors, they spoke to the survivors' families. They are supportive of the science that's being done there. And they constantly try to update those folks, and it's treated with tremendous respect.
All right. That is Chris Reddy, a scientist with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution on Cape Cod. Chris, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
My pleasure, Mark.
As 2025 comes to an end, here at the show, we're getting a little nostalgic over a year that I think we can all agree was, well, memorable. Over the next couple weeks, we'll be sharing some favorite interviews and stories from the past 12 months. And we begin today with a conversation about Mahjong, a game that's grown in global popularity in 2025. But our conversation actually began closer to home, right here in the studio with Mark and I, exploring our own relationship to the game. Mark, I don't know if you remember this, but back in May, Scottsdale resident and Mahjong enthusiast Lisa Sullivan stopped by the station to give us a lesson in how to play Mahjong.
I do remember that. At least I remember we tried to learn how to play Mahjong.
Yes. It ended up being not so much a lesson as a realization that Mahjong is super hard to play.
Yes.
And that was not Lisa's fault. She showed up with all these really beautiful Mahjong tiles and scoring cards, and she was talking us through how to play this particular version of the game. But as we all kind of discovered, the version she was teaching us was really different from the game that you and I thought we knew.
Indeed. And we actually have a little bit of tape from the moment all three of us realized exactly what was going on.
Okay, so I'm, as we're talking about this, I'm feeling super nervous because I think of myself as having played Mahjong so many times.
Right.
But so little of what you were just laying out is recognizable to me.
Okay, all right.
Which I think is...
So we're playing for money then.
We're playing for my money.
Right.
Like, what sound is your fun?
I've learned how to play where, like, you just have, like, certain runs of tiles, and once you've used all of your tiles, you win.
Okay. Well, I don't know how to play that way. So you can teach us.
I'm not sure I'd be any qualified to teach that. But no, I mean...
So... For those who aren't familiar with Mahjong, this is going to be a crude description, but it's sort of a cross between dominoes and poker. There are Chinese versions of it, Japanese versions, Americanized versions, but the basic gist is that everyone gets this group of thick white tiles with these beautiful designs on them. The designs are basically suits, like in a deck of cards. Only in Mahjong, the suits are things like dragons or dots or bamboo. And the rules of what you do with these tiles, as Mark and I learned, vary widely from version to version, culture to culture, and critically, from family to family. And that, according to Nicole Wong, who recently published a book about Mahjong, is where the game gets really interesting.
The game just kind of holds this space for memories, and it's an easy way to chat with people, I guess. And I am always just fascinated with what people have to say, whether it's something about the game itself, a trick that they do or a house rule, or just like the person that they learn from. Or
yeah, it seems to me, if I'm not mistaken, that that is not just a phenomenon that you have observed, but also one that you have lived, right, in your own journey with Mahjong and how it's played in your own family.
Yeah, definitely. I learned how to play from my grandparents when I had just graduated from college one summer. I went and lived with them for just a month, but I played with them a lot. And when I started to take it more seriously in terms of documenting the rules for playing Mahjong, I couldn't kind of extract that knowledge without hearing stories about my family or my grandparents or aunts and uncles. It's kind of a game that when you explain how to play it, because it's more often explained when you're playing in the moment. It's just like the easiest way to explain it is to say, oh, you know, your Auntie Carolyn, you know, your Auntie Carolyn loves to do this, or, you know, that's a real move. You know, your Auntie Janice always does this when this situation arises. So there's a lot of like personality that comes through.
Yeah. You mentioned a moment ago that part of this journey for you was actually trying to physically document the rules of the way that your family played the game. And as you did that, you began to realize that the rules, which are very specific of the way your family plays Mahjong, would not necessarily apply at another Mahjong table with other players.
That's right. Yeah. And particularly the scoring systems can be really different. It felt impossible to play the game if I wasn't playing with my family.
Yeah.
I don't know. That really led me to the documentation part of it. And then once I built up that foundation of my own family's rules, it made it a lot easier to kind of compare that to other styles.
Yeah. Well, can I ask you, I am a Mahjong player also. My brother taught me how to play. And
amazing.
We have this version that we play whenever I'm at home. Myself, my wife, my brother, and my mom, we sit around the table and we play Mahjong after dinner. And if we added it all up, it's probably hundreds of hours of Mahjong. And in getting ready to talk to you today, we had somebody come in to do a little Mahjong lesson for myself and Mark, one of my co-hosts on the show.
Awesome.
And
it was like she was speaking radio static, the way she was talking about the game. I had no...
Yes, you're like, wait a second, I thought I knew how to play this game.
I've played this game so many times, I was telling myself. My
and
question...
Isn't that like kind of an awful feeling?
Yes, thank you for saying that.
Because like that, for me, I was like, wait a second, this thing that I thought was so core to my family, and it sounds like you too, like it's like you have these very specific experience, you feel like, you know, it's familiar, whatever. And then all of a sudden you're like, what? Like,
yes.
What is happening? Yeah.
The feeling honestly was, and I'd be curious to know if you relate to this. It was like, I know this, but I don't understand this.
Yeah. You're like, this feels, I mean, I talk about Mahjong a lot about, I compare it to like different languages. So, You know, there's like traditional Chinese Mahjong and its variations. And then there's, say, Japanese Ricci Mahjong, and there's American style Mahjong. And then even within those styles, there's like different quote, like dialects. Wait, so yeah. So then what happened? Did you all play? Did you work it out? Did you?
Not really. No. I mean, it ended up being a conversation about, because Mark, who again is one of the co-hosts on the show, was in a similar situation to me where he was operating under the impression that he knew how to play Mahjong and realized in the course of doing this that he just knows how to play the version of Mahjong that he has been taught. And yes, I knew a different one. Mm-hmm. And it felt in the moment like, oh, it would take several hours of intense focus to unwind all of the different associations that we have specifically to our family's version of this game to get to a version that we could actually play together.
Which kind of does lead you to just like, okay, well, we'll just play with the four of us forever.
Yes.
which is also okay, like if that just is going to be your thing. Uh-huh. I think that's another part of what I'm doing is also to make conversation around that. Because it's totally fine if like your family just wants to play that way like forever and not bring in new people. You know what I mean? But
yeah.
Like I think just like that idea that like you felt very disoriented, you know, having... Uh-huh. Learning another thing. I think for me, what was also compounding that when I was first experiencing that was like, I grew up in Santa Monica in Southern California. My family's from New Zealand. And so this thing of Mahjong that I always felt was cultural knowledge that I thought I understood. Uh-huh. All of a sudden, I was like, wait a second, do I not even understand what this is? And so
right.
I think just like, I don't know, for my own Chinese American experience, I do think there's something kind of like juicy and complicated there where it's like this idea where we're, you know, for me, I did not grow up speaking Chinese. I grew up in a predominantly white neighborhood. And so I don't have a strong connection to like China. But culturally, there are certain traditions, like food is a very obvious thing to think about when you think about like heritage and cultures that get kind of like that we hold on to and pass down. Language is another one. And for me, it's kind of like Mahjong was a really interesting, different type of thing to think about.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Boy, Nicole, you know, I mean, the way you're talking about this, it feels like this really profound idea about Mahjong, which is that when we talk about a game like this, it's like you're not really talking about the game. You're talking about who you are in a certain way. Mm-hmm. Because to realize I don't know the game the way I thought I did, or I don't know the game at all, is in some way tantamount to saying I don't know my own family. I don't know my own history. I don't know my own self. And it makes me think about that thing you said earlier about the game being this ideal container for memories.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I'm so glad that that's like coming across because that's totally how I think about it. And for my family, it's like we're competitive. We're not like super sentimental. Uh-huh. Like I don't know. Like there's something about it being a game just fits.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. That's something I was thinking about getting ready to talk to you. Is there is this way with Mahjong where knowing how to play it implies not just time spent with other people, but a certain kind of time.
Yeah. And I like that we're talking more about like the regular game too, like in the sense of your family, because like it's also just like, oh, when you get together, that's what you do. It's like a plan that you can make that isn't really a plan, right? It's like in lieu of saying, let's sit around and talk to each other. Like it's like, oh, let's play Mahjong.
Well, Nicole Wong is a writer and the author of Mahjong, House Rules from Across the Asian Diaspora. Nicole, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Well, that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Sam, should we play a game of Mahjong once you get off the air?
I think so. I think okay. So. Let's get those tiles clacking.
All right. It is a satisfying clack, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah.
And it makes me think of the holidays with family. So.
Absolutely. All right. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.